Welcome back to the Thermodiet Podcast. I'm your host, Jake Miller, and today I have on the podcast Mr. Georgi Dinkov. So today we actually talk about sex. So we talk about what usually happens whenever sex drive or erectile problems arise. What is the optimal amount of sex? We talk a little bit about masturbation versus sex, and then the best way to prepare, perform, and recover for sex. So it's actually a really interesting podcast. I learned a lot myself. I'm looking forward to being able to hear what you learn as well. So let's dive in. Welcome back, guys. Today I am here once again with Georgi Dinkov. How are you doing today, Georgi?
Hi, everybody. Pretty good.
How is it up there in DC right now?
Less military on the streets. I would say people still seem tense, but less tense than, let's say, like January, February timeframe. And, you know, everybody's starting to ditch the masks and ignore the official, because the rules are still there. Basically, you're supposed to be wearing a mask in public. And I have two small kids, so when we go to the playground, we would see people up until middle of February where they were all masked up. The kids, the parents, etc. But now it seems like, at the very least, the children are no longer wearing them, and the parents are starting to congregate in bigger and bigger groups, and most of them are not wearing masks. So I think it's basically the public is slowly stopping to care about the pandemic and just getting on with their lives.
Yes, sir. Definitely. Boulder's still kind of on eggshells right now after the shooting on Monday, but I'm sure it'll slowly come back around.
Yeah, and ironically, there was this article on, I think it was on Zero Hedge, one of the more fringe websites, said that the fact that we had two mass shootings over the last 2 weeks or so, in a strange way, signals a return to normal, right? Because when people were locked up in their houses and nobody was leaving, right, there weren't any mass shootings. So now that these things are happening, it seems that basically people are out in the open, and all of that pent up anger and frustration and whatnot from the lockdowns and losing a job or, you know, getting your mental health deteriorate. Now it's all in, you know, full open view. And that's the result we're seeing. So they're saying basically like, now we're going to see the results of all this more than a year of restrictions. We already saw, two unfortunate results of that. Hopefully there will not be any more. But at the very least, people are, I guess, that's a sign that people are saying enough is enough. I'm out of my house because if I stay here, I may harm myself or my family. And then they'll, you know, going outside.
Definitely. So do you think that there'll be like a slow rise and then a fall over time?
Yeah, I think that initially there will be an increase in violence, because when people were, you know, stuck at home, the reason we saw a decline in violence was simply because there wasn't anybody around to be violent against, except for the domestic violence, which a lot of studies said that, you know, during the pandemic went mostly unreported, or at the very least it was unaddressed, because even the local authorities were saying, unless it's something egregious, like somebody's trying to shoot their spouse or their children, or, you know, do grieving, what is it called, grave bodily harm, they just wouldn't return call. They wouldn't address calls saying like, my relatives are being too aggressive. They'll ask like, is anybody harmed? Do you think they're harmed to themselves or may harm others? As long as the answer is no, they wouldn't care, right? That they'll just drop the call. While in more open times, they'll try to go and address every call, whether that's good or not, whether that leads to escalations or not, it's anybody's guess. But I think now that all the spent up anger and frustration is now spilling over onto the street, we'll see if people feel like they can, you know, vent their anger against politicians. We may see some more some protests, maybe a return of the BLM/Antifa protests, but now this time joined by basically more moderate and even Republican protesters. Everybody's protesting about the fact that now it will be plainly obvious that for a lot of people their livelihood is gone. So we'll see how this plays out. But yeah, I do expect maybe up until early summer, as the country starts to reopen more and more, to see an increase in violence, and eventually things settle down, simply because nobody can be violent forever.
Definitely. Yeah, man. It's definitely some interesting times that we're living in right now.
Yeah. I don't know that anybody has lived in times like this. You know, as they said, the millennials have already endured a third once-in-a-generation recession / depression, right? First, it was the dot-com boom. Then it was the 2008 financial crisis. And now it's the pandemic. And even though the focus is on the virus, we're now starting to see that, you know, there are economical consequences of that. That most people were, you know, they were too preoccupied thinking about the virus and, you know, being afraid of it and trying to save their lives. And now when they slowly, little by little, realizing that it's safe for most people, right? It's not that dangerous. Now the focus shifts towards, oh my God, what am I going to do? I will get laid off once the moratorium expires, or I'll get evicted once the moratorium on eviction expires. Now these things are coming to the forefront. And I think that's what's driving a lot of people to commit these acts of violence, because if you don't have options and you realize your livelihood is gone, I mean, what are you to do with yourself?
Definitely, man. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. So yep. I'd like to hop into the main subject of the podcast today. I'm actually super excited to kind of get your take on this, because I haven't really heard you directly talk about sex specifically. So what do you think usually happens whenever sex drive, or for men specifically, there's a lot of men that listen to this podcast, whenever erectile problems arise?
So basically, most of the erectile problems are directly linked to stress. And the reason I say that is because it's well known in psychology and psychiatry that as soon as cortisol rises, and it's been confirmed by both animal studies and human studies, as soon as cortisol starts to rise, whenever you're under stress, that happens in a matter of seconds, right? Within the next 15 to 20 minutes or so, there is a plunge of testosterone by, as much as 90%, 90. Now, of course, if that acute stress is removed, then the testosterone levels recover, right? But if that doesn't happen, if you're under chronic, mild grade, chronic unpredictable mild stress, CUMS comes, which is kind of appropriate for the podcast today. It's a very well established model in animal studies of inducing depression, and basically this increase, chronic increase in cortisol downregulates the cortisol, or the glucocorticoid receptors. So it leads to long-term inflammation because the body simply doesn't respond as well to cortisol. And also leads to chronic downregulation of steroidogenesis in the gonads and also in peripheral tissues as well. Now, some of that can be compensated for by the increase in young and or healthy people. Whenever cortisol rises, some anti-cortisol steroids also rise together with it to protect from some of the negative side effects. And in young people, usually a rise in cortisol is accompanied by a rise in dihydroepiandrosterone, DHEA, pregnenolone, and progesterone. And those three steroids happen to have anti-cortisol effects. And that's why usually in young and or healthy people, doing a little bit of an exercise, which tends to raise your cortisol, a little bit, not too much, right, tends to actually lead to an increase in sexual desire. And, of course, if you have a partner, increase in sexual activity after exercise. And this is one of the reasons what has led many doctors to recommend exercise for improving sexual function. However, it has been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that advice does not work in people who are chronically stressed. If your cortisol is already chronically elevated, the last thing on earth you would want to do is go for a run, for several mile run, which will spike your cortisol even more, downregulate the sensitivity of the cortisol receptors even more. And then for males, there are these cells in the testicles called the Leydig cells that produce testosterone. And there are also the Sertoli cells, which produce dihydrotestosterone. Cortisol directly blocks the functioning of both of these types of cells. So if you're already in a situation where you're mildly hypogonadal, namely because of the chronic stress, in other words, your gonads are being, their activity is being suppressed because of the elevated cortisol, you don't want to be stressing yourself even more. Several groups, research groups, have kind of wisened up on this fact and are now have shown that you can actually treat stress-induced hypogonadism, stress-induced sexual dysfunction, stress-induced lack of, inability to perform, or what do you call it, erectile dysfunction, or in general, or premature ejaculation. You can actually treat it by administering a glucocorticoid receptor antagonist. There's this drug known as the abortion pill, RU486, also known as mifepristone. And most people know it is the abortion pill because it blocks the progesterone receptor, which is necessary for pregnancy. However, it also blocks the cortisol receptor as well. And in fact, it was developed as a cortisol blocker. There just wasn't much market for it. And it continued being marketed for progesterone as an abortion pill instead of for blocking cortisol exclusively. So that anti-cortisol pill has been shown to restore sexual desire and sexual performance in animal models, and now tested in a few small scale human studies as well, in humans as well, that have depression or any kind of a seasonal affective disorder, lack of energy, which is all related to basically a decline in the energetic, in the oxidative phosphorylation in the brain, which ultimately leads to this feeling of like always fatigued, lack of desire, also known as anhedonia, right? Lack of desire. You don't experience joy and you know, pleasure from things. All of these things are due to the elevations of cortisol and serotonin. Speaking of serotonin, another neurotransmitter, cortisol is hormone, but the serotonin being neurotransmitter, which is also very intimately involved in sexual performance. One of the notorious side effects which most users experience of the drugs known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, they're prescribed for depression. Unfortunately, they absolutely destroy the sexual desire and performance of virtually anybody who is taking them. And there's a very good reason for that. Basically, serotonin and dopamine, which is a pro-sexual, pro-creative, pro-joy and hedonic neurotransmitter, they're inversely correlated. And basically, anytime serotonin rises, which what happens when you take the SSRI drugs, you're going to be suppressing dopamine. Also, anytime serotonin rises, you'll be increasing cortisol, because cortisol secretion is actually centrally controlled. In other words, when you're under stress, in order for your adrenals to get the signal that you're under stress, that has to come from the brain. That's the center of perception. So the whole hypothalamo pituitary adrenal axis starts at the hypothalamus, which is part of your brain. Anytime you're under stress, cortisol and serotonin rise, and both of these have basically anti-sexual effects from multiple mechanisms. Cortisol decimates the ability to produce the pro-sexual steroids, such as testosterone, and eventually even DHEA. Even though I said DHEA often rises together with cortisol, that happens in younger and or healthier people. DHEA levels start to plummet after the age of 35, while cortisol levels stay at the level of a 20-year-old, unless you get into adrenal failure, which is very rare, known as Addison disease. For most people, they maintain their cortisol levels at the level of a 20-year-old, but after the age of 35, the anti-cortisol hormones, which are pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, and testosterone, and dihydrotestosterone, the levels of those steroids plummets. So there's nothing to oppose cortisol. So that's one of the main reasons why older people are less interested in sex and less able to perform sexually, because they are, even if they're not under chronic stress, the fact that their cortisol levels stay largely the same to the level there of a 20-year-old, but however you're now lacking the anti-cortisol steroids, you're basically in a state of relative cortisol excess. And now many doctors have started to ditch the actual simple cortisol test. Instead, they're all now always trying to test cortisol together with one of the anti-cortisol hormones and determine your health by the ratio. So in other words, the cortisol to the DHEA ratio, or the cortisol to the testosterone ratio, or the cortisol to the dihydrotestosterone ratio is a much better indicator of your overall gonadal, which ultimately means sexual health, than just measuring cortisol, because your cortisol may come back normal, right? But if your anti-cortisol / pro-sexual steroids are low, you're still in the same boat. You're basically lacking the desire and lacking the ability to perform. So, which means, I already mentioned, blocking cortisol or reducing its synthesis helps restore sexual potency and function and the ability to perform. And also blocking serotonin is now known very well. It should be known for a while, but through an indirect finding. There's a drug called bromocriptine, which is used to treat Parkinson's disease, and it's basically a dopamine agonist and has some partial serotonin antagonism / agonism. But in general, the overall effects of the drug when used at the clinically prescribed doses is actually heavily pro-dopamine and anti-serotonin. In fact, there are several studies demonstrating you can treat Cushing disease, which is excessive production of cortisol, by administering bromocriptine, which demonstrates that cortisol production, excessive cortisol production, is under the control of the brain, of the central mechanism. They had noticed that when they were treating elderly people with Parkinson's disease, because used to be, not anymore, now younger people are starting to get Parkinson as well. But back in the 70s and 80s, Parkinson's disease was an old person's disease, specifically old male person disease, more often than not, in a ratio of about 4-1 to even 5-1. So most of the hospitalized people with Parkinson's disease were elderly males. And when they were giving them bromocriptine, they noticed that they started to pay exorbitant amount of attention to the female nursing staff. And they basically started to investigate more what are the mechanisms behind that effect. And through several animal studies, they basically quickly figured out that it's prolactin, which dopamine opposes, and serotonin that are responsible for the lack of desire, for having sexual intercourse. And also, by administering these anti-prolactin, pro-dopamine, anti-serotonin drugs, all these effects are related. Anything that promotes dopamine will inhibit prolactin and serotonin. Anything that promotes either serotonin or prolactin will inhibit dopamine, promote cortisol, and basically inhibit sexual function. So they noticed that basically when they inhibit prolactin/serotonin by giving these pro-dopamine drugs, they're also not only were they restoring sexual function in chronically stressed animals or elderly animals that were hypogonadal because of lack of production of the prosexual steroids, but also they were reducing their so-called refractory period, which is after a single sexual intercourse. It's well known that it's jokingly known as like the male nap or whatever. It's like, so basically the male has performed, has done its duties, and then he turns over and he falls asleep, the post-coital slumber. So, and then for several hours, you basically leave that man alone so that he can recover. Well, he found out that if you administer these drugs, actually the male can have multiple orgasms similar to the way females do. Quickly, little by little, they realized that the ability, the desire to have sexual intercourse and the ability to perform well is largely controlled by two mechanisms. One, which is, the sexual desire is largely driven by the sexual steroids, such as testosterone, DHEA, progesterone, and maybe even dihydrotestosterone a little bit, in both sexes, by the way. Males and females produce all of these steroids just in different amounts, right? And then the second portion was basically the prolactin, serotonin, dopamine axis is what I like to call. And that is more responsible for the ability to recover and the ability to experience joy from sex. So in other words, the hedonic portion of sex is largely driven by the brain, by the neurotransmitters and their interplay in the brain. The FDA recently approved a drug for treating female sexual dysfunction, and it's the drug is called flibanserin. And flibanserin is basically a partial serotonin antagonist. And even though initially all the feminist groups came out and said, this is terrible, women don't need to be medicated in order to have sex, this is such a remnant of the patriarchy that there's this mythology of the sexually dysfunctional frigid woman that needs to be cured of her dysfunction in order to perform. However, flibanserin sales are through the roof, and it seems to be working very well, which seems to at least partially confirm the hypothesis that at least part of sexual dysfunction in females is largely driven by insufficiency of dopamine or excessive serotonin, because the drug is actually partial serotonin antagonist and partial dopamine agonist, similar to bromocriptine. And in fact, back in the day, when these studies were done with the Parkinson's disease patients, like I said, most of them were male, but not all of them. So they also noticed in those wards where they were treating Parkinson's disease patients, they did notice that the females were starting to get frisky as well. Now, they weren't like the males starting to directly chase the male staff, right? The males were actually much more open and aggressive and going after the nurses, the female nurses. But it was, you know, they conducted, because they were doing these regular checkups and on their mental health as well. And part of the assessment is sexual desire, sexual function, right? Erotic dreams, because it's part of the overall health picture. If you go to your doctor, typically, I think even the FDA now recommends that they, even your primary care physician, should be examining or asking you questions about your sexual life and, you know, how you're feeling overall. Do you think, like, you know, there's something missing there, something lacking? It is a great indicator of health. So anyways, they found out, even with bromocriptine, that it was helping restore female sexuality, even in very elderly patients. I mean, most of the females with Parkinson's disease are in their, 75 and older. And at that age, the general perception, even based on interviews or even as a societal stereotype, is that after the age of 75, you don't really expect most women to be very interested in sex. It turns out they can be made interested in sex if you control this excess of prolactin and serotonin, and which ultimately results in control of cortisol, restoration of the hormonal, proper hormonal balance. And there you go. You have older people being just as willing and capable of having fulfilling sexual lives.
So for bromocriptine and the progesterone antagonist that you were talking about, is there a compensatory mechanism with those two?
What do you mean compensatory?
Like, if you were to take it for a certain amount of time, would there be a compensation effect afterwards?
So for the progesterone antagonist, you don't want to be antagonizing your progesterone receptors for too long, especially if you're a female, right? I mean, first of all, it would make pregnancy almost impossible. It's known to terminate already existing pregnancy. That's why it's sold and approved as an abortion pill. Actually, officially, it's not approved as a cortisol blocker. The French company that developed in the 80s designed it as a cortisol blocker, but they tried to sell it as a cortisol blocker. They couldn't because the market was too small. Cushing disease is very, very rare, maybe one in 100,000. And now it's becoming much more prevalent, but still one in 10,000. So again, if you're a pharmaceutical company, you're looking to sell at the biggest market, right? And then the marketing team realized that with the rise of feminism and sexual liberation, and the sale of contraceptives, it would be a great market to sell this drug as a progesterone blocker, which it was also doing, but as a side effect. It's like, it's better as a cortisol blocker than it is as a progesterone blocker, but the market was better for progesterone blockers, and that's how it ended up entering society's collective psyche, and now it's known as the abortion pill. But again, it was designed for treating Cushing disease. I don't think there's any there's much of a problem in terms of the suppression of the cortisol receptors unless you are abusing it. I mean, there are people with severe Cushing disease which actually have a tumor in the pituitary gland. And don't, either don't want to have surgery for it, or they can. Sometimes the tumor is too large and has already grown into, starting to grow into brain tissue. And as such, basically, these people are deciding that they don't want to have the surgery. So for them, the only option is either a cortisol blocker, such as for RU486, and for that purpose, for actual Cushing disease, the dosage is 600 milligrams to 1,200 milligrams daily. That's massive. Most of the abortion pill dosage is 100 to 200 daily. Excuse me, I'm getting these calls. So basically, the blockade of cortisol receptors, even at these very high dosages, is not known to lead to many side effects, except actually potentially cure diabetes type 2, which there is a clinical trial for that as well with RU486. They found out by accident that it rapidly drops blood glucose in poorly controlled diabetes type 2. So they put these men on, I think it was like 200 milligrams of RU486. The trial is still ongoing, but one part is already complete and several studies have been published on it. And then there was a rapid normalization of blood glucose and slowly over time, loss of weight as well. So that would be really the danger. If you're already in good weight, you may drop some additional weight, but it will not be muscle. Actually, cortisol blockers are now known, the blockade of cortisol receptors is now known to be responsible for most of the anabolic effects of the steroids that bodybuilders abuse. So it may actually help you build some muscle as well. The problem with RU486 is that it is actually a synthetic steroid derived, the core of the steroid is the same as estrogen. So RU486 is actually an estrane type steroid. And there is some concern that estrogen-type steroids exert systemic, indirect estrogenic effects simply because their core is the same as estradiol or any of the different type of estrogens. It is an 18-carbon chain steroid. The androgens are 19 carbons, and then the pregnenolones, such as pregnenolone and progesterone, are 21 carbons. And even though this drug, and there are several actually anabolic steroids that are also estrogens, those are actually already known to have estrogenic effects. That's why I'm suspecting that if RU486, it was developed from these, it was actually developed using one of those anabolic steroids, and that steroid is known as nandrolone, is known to have estrogenic effects and convert it to estrogen. Now, RU486, there are no studies showing you can convert it to estrogen, but the core of the steroid is still an estrogen. So I would be wary of it. Now, can you do something similar with another steroid? I think so. There are several studies from the early 20th century demonstrating pro-fertility and pro-sexual effect of taking larger doses of pregnenolone. Pregnenolone, one of its effects, aside from being a precursor to all the other steroids, is that it's also a cortisol blocker, not as potent as, let's say, progesterone, which I'm going to talk about next, but it's still pretty potent, and the higher the dosage, the more effective it becomes. So they found out that administering 200 to 400 milligrams orally daily of pregnenolone to infertile males that had problems with the sperm count, morphology, motility, they basically found out that their fertility was restored to normal, which usually means, because all of these parameters depend actually on testosterone and dihydrotestosterone, which greatly suggests, but at the time, they weren't very adept at measuring these steroids. They were not really isolated yet. They didn't know how to test for your, like, let's say, blood levels of testosterone, dihydrotestosterone. Strongly suggested that the intake of pregnenolone normalized the hormonal balance of these males, and it was the hormonal imbalance that was at the core of their infertility and sexual dysfunction. So you can also use progesterone. Progesterone used to be known up until the, I would say, early 80s as the main endogenous blocker of cortisol at the receptor level. So progesterone is very much like RU486, equally potent as a cortisol blocker, but it's actually an agonist at the progesterone receptor. Several good things come out of this. Many doctors are saying, well, it's a female hormone. Men shouldn't be messing with it. That's actually not true. Before puberty, males and females produce about the same amount of progesterone, 30 to 50 milligrams daily. So it's the decline of progesterone with age. Now, with women during childbearing age, basically they have successful pregnancies, they have drastic increase in progesterone for over a period of 9 months. And it's been shown that if the women don't have pregnancies, their life expectancy drastically declines, and also the risk of all kinds of diseases not only equals that of males, traditionally considered male diseases, such as, I don't know, like cardiovascular disease, brain ischemic disease, Parkinson's disease, all of these things, the risk drastically increases, and women actually end up living, their life expectancy drops even below that of males. And naturally, if you take a population of women that have had children, and then you take a regular population of men, the life expectancy of men is up to 7 years shorter than women. However, if you take a cohort of women that have not had children, in other words, their progesterone levels didn't get the chance to spike over a period of 9 months, two or three times throughout their lifetime, let's say, then their basically their life expectancy is at the level of the males or even below. And the risk of all of the disease that the male have is at least equal, if not even higher, because females do tend to produce more estrogen than males do, at least in their younger years. And if the progesterone is not there to counterbalance the estrogen, so progesterone is the cortisol blocker and an estrogen blocker as well, then all of the negative effects of this unopposed estrogen, even if it's within the normal range of the lab tests, all of these effects of unopposed estrogen start to manifest themselves. So you can try to do the same thing that estrogen that is done with RU486 for a hormonal balance or recovery of your hormonal balance with progesterone. A number of studies have demonstrated that progesterone in moderate doses, which most of these studies were with animals, but there are a few human as well, that even in males, taking 50 to 100 milligrams of progesterone actually greatly improved sexual function. And the studies were actually relatively short-lived. They didn't examine, they didn't see much of a difference, much of a change in the hormonal balance. But if your sexual desire and performance improves, it has to affect the hormonal balance. It just wasn't, the administration wasn't performed long enough for the effect to manifest itself. And doses equivalent in animal studies of 200 milligrams or more of progesterone did start to have an anti-sexual effect in males. However, still maintained the pro-sexual effects in females, which means that if you're a female, there's no need to use RU486. You can get all the benefits of RU486 without the risks, plus the additional benefits by simply using bioidentical progesterone. For males, lower dosage progesterone, 50 to 100 milligrams, and if you check your blood levels of things like DHEA, especially the sulfated form, if that is on the lower end, the bottom 25% of the normal range for your age group, then adding a little bit of DHEA amplifies greatly the effect of this low to moderate dosage of progesterone. So you can ditch the RU486. The RU486 is just an example that the blockade of the cortisol receptors, or at least providing steroids that can balance these anti-sexual effects of cortisol, can greatly relieve the majority of the cases of sexual lack of sexual desire and or dysfunction. And for those people where this is not sufficient, I think it would warrant to do a blood test for prolactin and whole blood serotonin, and see where those stand, because without an exception, if there is if the hormonal balance thing did not work, usually there's an excess of prolactin and serotonin, and those need to be addressed. So far, I'm not aware of a published case study where a person presented with sexual dysfunction and the doctors could not relieve it, treat it, cure it, by addressing either the hormonal or the neurotransmitter pathway. So all of these things are curable / treatable, and most of them stem from chronic stress, poor diet, and in general, living in an environment where basically you feel like you don't matter, you don't have much of a choice, so you're being forced to do things that you don't particularly like.
So what would you suggest as the ultimate Casanova, I guess, routine, so to speak? So to prepare, perform, and recover from it, what would you kind of suggest?
So if the person doesn't have any sexual dysfunction or lack of sexual desire or problems with performing in bed, removing as much of routine as possible from your life for a few days before, first of all, I don't like the planned sex. Now this become very fashionable, especially in couples therapy, where basically they go see a therapist. Therapists, of course, ask about their sexual life because it is a big picture of successful marriages / relationships, and the people will say, well, we just don't have time for that because we're both too busy. And the therapist will say, okay, I need you to schedule the sex on a regular basis. And as soon as you do that, most of the benefit from sex disappears. The whole point of sex is you have to think of it as art. If I tell you, Jayton, schedule Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and I want you to create a new song because you're a musician, right?
Mess around with it, yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, if somebody were to tell you, I want you to come up with a new song and create a new song every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you think that would work very well? I mean, you may be able to do it once, maybe, right? But the whole point of, look, I'm going to order you, basically, to spike up your creativity on these specific days on demand. Doesn't work like that. Sex is the same way. Think of sex as an art, as basically whenever you feel in the mood, there's a reason why there's this expression. That's when it needs to be done. But in order for you to feel in the mood, there needs to be more spontaneity in your lifestyle. So removing some of the routines around the things that lead to sex usually tends to greatly improve its quality, satisfaction, and even during the actual sexual activity, during the actual performance of the sex act itself, which means if you have a scheduled date with your partner on Tuesday night, I strongly recommend you don't schedule it. Basically, agree that you will try to take care of specific tasks that are preventing you from going on a date for the next week. Like, let's say, like, put a little bit of extra effort of taking care of chores or things that are interfering with your ability to be spontaneous and do things that you want. And then for several days, just do things that you like. I mean, doesn't have to be necessarily together. Even if one person goes out to do their hobby, the other one goes out with her, his or her friends, right? But eventually, after 2 or 3 days, as the new experiences and excitement from life builds up, there is a natural tendency in humans to try to share that excitement with a person they care and or love. And that's when really sex manifests. It is not a just a physiological need that basically can be satisfied on demand, like with eating. It's actually, it is a physiological need, but it goes much deeper than that. It's part of your creative instinct. And just as your creative interest as a musician, as a as an artist, as a you know actor or whatever, since it cannot, it should not be scheduled and forced, the same way with sex. You should be working around it to remove the barriers to sex instead of focusing on the on somehow, you know, scheduling it and then basically that's it. We've agreed that on Tuesday at 9 p.m., curtains fall and we get, you know, we're getting jiggy with it, right? It doesn't work like that. I mean, it may work for some people, but I don't know of any couple that had a positive long-term experience by scheduling their sexual activity. And then in terms of the, you know, so the spontaneity should take care because it's been shown that spontaneous activity lowers cortisol, lowers prolactin, and increases dopamine. And basically these things by themselves should already in a relatively healthy person be enough to spur sexual desire. It's a natural fact of life. Younger people that have, to them, the world is new. They're experiencing new things every day and they tend to want to have more sex. And it all, it's all an interplay between the novelty, which, you know, has an effect on neurotransmitters in a pro-sexual way, and you know the fact that they're healthier and their hormones are in a better state, and that's what manifests in a better sex. So for older people, if there is there is some kind of a you know hormonal problem, that can be helped with some of the things that I mentioned, and often just going on a unplanned vacation just if it's like you know going outside of town for a night and book a, like a random hotel in the suburbs if you live in the city just for one night and coming back tends to greatly remove this this impediment on spontaneous sexual activity. So less routine, more spontaneity, don't force the sex, don't worry about the actual that specific, don't even put it on your calendar. Put things on your calendar like, oh, I need to take care of this chore and I need to basically, you know, enable a few more days with some extra free time for both of the people involved. And then things will naturally fall into their place. If there is a hormonal issue or a proven neurotransmitter issue, then the hormonal things I already mentioned, the doctor can prescribe bromocriptine. Some of the there's some over-the-counter things that work as relatively good serotonin blockers, such as Benadryl, you know, cyproheptadine, famotidine, which is an acid blocker. Cyproheptadine is not over-the-counter, but the doctor is usually wouldn't have much of a problem prescribing because it's an anti-allergy drug. They treat it as such. And most doctors don't even know that it's also a serotonin blocker. But Benadryl is over-the-counter in doses up to 50 milligrams. It acts mostly as a histamine and serotonin blocker. Don't go over 100 milligrams because then it starts to act as an SSRI. So a lot of its anti-serotonin effects will get compensated by the fact that it will inhibit the uptake of serotonin. And usually, you know, to see the pro-sexual effects, 25 to 50 milligrams is plenty. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's really simple. If you treat sex just like as any other activity that you want to enjoy, you will quickly see that routinizing it, mechanizing it, scheduling it, in other words, stressing about it, it's not very conductive to a very pleasant and fruitful experience for both sexes. I know it's easier said than done because we live in, like we said, very interesting times. People feel like, you know, they don't have control over many things, but you'll be surprised how much control you have over these things if you can take care of a few things in your life that seem like they have to be done every day or they cannot be avoided. If they can be avoided even artificially for a day or two, usually sexual activity recovers pretty quickly.
Interesting. So why would you say that sex is more optimal than autoeroticism or masturbation? Because I've heard several studies as to why that's not good. I'm also interested in kind of like the NoFap idea. So a lot of people are into that as well. And I was wondering if there's any significance to it.
So basically, the reason I think that sex is preferable to masturbation are twofold. First of all, you're interacting with another human being. And there are many things that cannot be substituted by simple visual and audio stimulation. In other words, if you're watching something erotic online or on your TV, it's a pretty close substitute. But studies have shown that the response of the neurotransmitters is very different between real sexual activity and masturbation. For masturbation, basically, you have a not very robust rise in prolactin. But after the orgasm, the prolactin actually stays elevated for much longer. So in other words, you have a very long refractory period, and it's basically the quick decline in prolactin from regular sex, which has been shown to lead to the perception of greater sexual satisfaction. And that the fact that it's basically, part of it is probably that the feeling that you're ready to go again. While with the masturbation or like some other kinds of artificial stimulation, the fact that most people feel that this is not the real thing probably leads to some kind of a stress experience, which leads to the prolactin not having this quick spike, basically having like a little bit of a spike, maybe about halfway to what a real orgasm with a partner would do, but then also staying at that level for up to 24 hours. And the fact that high prolactin being a pituitary hormone, it's not a good thing, as we've discussed in previous shows. It leads to elevations of TSH, which has multiple pro-inflammatory and anti-gonadal effects, further leads in prolactin. So, and if the person is already under stress, their cortisol and prolactin are probably already going to be at a level chronically, going to be at a higher baseline than optimal. So continuing to maintain it at that level by having these unsatisfying or less satisfying sexual experiences is probably not a good thing in the long term. Now, it's probably better than not having sex at all, because the whole NoFap movement, if you look at it started on Reddit, the social media site, maybe about 10 years ago. I was actually kind of interested in it because at the time I was just entering the repeat world, and I was kind of hesitant, you know, because they had some good points. And so far, the multiple studies that have been done that have actually studied scientifically show that whatever benefit you're getting from the so-called NoFap is mostly due to a rise of about 40 to 50% of baseline testosterone levels. And that leads to more confidence, better muscle tone, better overall health in males. And I think that's what they're attributing to the NoFap. But at the same time, it's been shown that the accumulation of seminal fluid, if it continues for more than, I think the average period was maybe 3 weeks, it starts to leak into the bloodstream, and it can actually start causing issues with prostate, colon, lower level of the colon, the sigmoid portion of the colon, even the rectum. So it can lead to prostatitis and in the long term, benign prostate hyperplasia, which is the prostate enlargement, and potentially even prostate cancer. It's been shown that male religious representatives who of course it's all done by interviews, they can't really monitor them 100%, but it's, you know, there's a fairly good certainty that they're telling the truth. The less sexual activity, the more prone they are to prostate cancer and various other cancers that are considered male-specific, such as lung cancer, neuroglioblastoma, which is a really deadly form, and even pancreatic cancer. So complete abstinence is known to not be a good thing in both males and females. A recent study with naked mole rats, which are the organism, the longest living rodent, I think, they live up to 30 years, and also they're known to almost never get cancer. And it was found out that even in those colonies, longevity was actually greatly segregated. The individuals that enjoyed good health, which was, again, was characterized to our early conversation by a lower cortisol to DHEA ratio and were engaging in more frequent sex, actually had the highest longevity of the entire colony. Still, even the short-lived ones lived to maybe about 15, 20 years, but the ones that were having proper sex and their hormonal balance was good one, they lived to 30 plus years, which is more than 30% more, right? It's up to 50% more. So that tells you something. I mean, basically that quality sexual experiences are very, very beneficial, and probably have a very, very deep and fundamental biochemical basis. Some upon of, you know, we've touched upon this, the hormonal and the neurotransmitter one, but ultimately it comes down to the fact that people are in optimal health when they're feeling free and being able to have an enjoyable experience. Sex is one of the greatest thrills in life. Be happy to have that experience when you want it, how you want it, and basically with a real willing and interesting partner is probably one of the greatest acts of freedom you can exercise in life. And that's, to me, that's one of the best explanations one can give for why sex is and should be a fundamental part of the life of a healthy person. The fact that we've gotten to the point where now the youngest generations are having the least sex than any other in the last 80 years, to me, is not a call for, oh, let's try to promote the young to have more sex. No, that's just going to have the opposite effect. Figure out why they're having less sex and change the environment, because it ultimately comes down to the fact that something in that environment is stressing these people or interfering with their health and or, which ultimately leads to a lack of sexual desire, because sexual desire is a luxury from a biochemical point of view. And if the organism is not in good health, creativity and sexual desire are two of the first things that the organism dispenses of, because they're non-crucial. The organism thinks is more important, in other words, survival-related things to do.
Definitely. So I have one more question that I'm kind of curious about, and then I'll let you go because I want to be respectful of your time. The idea of multiple sex partners like that, for instance, like hookup culture, do you deem one sexual partner as more beneficial or multiple sexual partners as the most beneficial?
I think it depends on the age. If you're younger, when you basically have a very quick refractory period and you're basically enamored with novelty, I don't think it's a problem to have multiple sexual partners. I think it becomes a problem when it becomes this, I don't want to call it promiscuosity, but this incessant desire for novelty transfers into middle age and older. It is usually, it's just like addiction. They call it addiction, but we already know there's no such thing. It is a compensatory mechanism for high cortisol and or low dopamine. Alcoholism has already been shown to work in the exact same way. Heroin addiction has been shown to work in the exact same way. And when you actually take these addicts, the famous rat part experiment, which I think we've mentioned before, and when you put them into a very, very exciting, challenging, new, stimulating environment, they can dump their heroin addiction over days, despite the fact that it's extremely painful and it leads to seizures, but these rats know it's not good for them and stop doing it. And it's the same thing has been shown in the so-called sex addicts. They have highly elevated levels, especially the females, of prolactin and estrogen, which in males suppress sexual function, but in females they actually promote it because it is a sign of poor health, and it may be a biological evolutionary mechanism that when times are tough, female promiscuosity is biologically promoted to simply increase the chance of procreation and ensure the survival of the species, even though it will be at the cost of, you know, less healthy children, or, you know, less stable lifestyle, which can lead to violence, financial insecurity and whatnot. But at the end of the day, the biological mechanisms are, it's been proven by multiple studies across different countries that people who are financially stable in good health, they tend to prefer a single partner after the age of, say, on average, say 30 to 35. And if they're 40s, they're continuing to be promiscuous, then usually it can be traced down to an endocrine, I don't want to call it disorder, but an endocrine imbalance, which usually has to do with elevated cortisol and prolactin and estrogen, because they go together hand in hand in females, and usually low testosterone in males. Now, it may strike you as a paradoxical. Why would a male with low testosterone be promiscuous? Because they cannot get proper satisfaction from the actual sex act. There are several studies I can show you after the podcast, at least one with pedophiles. It demonstrated, so pedophiles are known as sexual predators. Multiple studies have shown that they keep, no matter what you do, unless you chemically castrate them, they actually keep acting out on their fantasies. It was shown that almost the studies that were done, almost every single one of them had an issue with elevated prolactin, estrogen, or cortisol, and also while having low testosterone. So I think that maybe also a compensatory mechanism. First, the paraphilia, the pedophilic disorders seem to be related to more effeminate men, and also men who cannot get proper satisfaction with a regular partner because they feel inadequate. You know, a person, a male with this hormonal profile, would feel like they cannot really, you know, perform well with an actual woman of their age, or even keep a woman satisfied, you know, and they, that's why they turn into children, because they can control. And even more often than not, in these situations, like, the sexual predators don't actually have consumed the sexual act. They do other things. Remember the recent trial with Harvey Weinstein? Several women accused him, and he eventually got convicted. Every single one of them, except one, who happened to interact with Harvey Weinstein when he was young, much younger. I think he was like late 20s at the time. Every single other one of the accusers said that he did not actually have sexual intercourse with her, even though they expected that that would happen. No, it was actually almost exclusively masturbation in their presence. And they suspected one of the reasons was that he could not actually have a proper erection and was concerned that the sex act would not succeed and he would feel humiliated. So almost all of the sexual abuse that occurred actually did not involve even sexual contact. It was simply, you know, still a crime, but it was that person's inadequate performance in front of these women, because he felt like he could not perform. And if you look at Harvey Weinstein, he has a number of different unmistakable signs of elevated prolactin and estrogen, including gynecomastia, central obesity, puffiness of the face, slightly distorted facial features, et cetera. So it kind of goes along with the studies that also demonstrated these things, that excessive and twisted sexual desire in males tends to be driven by these hormones combined with low testosterone, while in women, just the elevation of either cortisol, prolactin, or estrogen was sufficient to drive this promiscuous behavior, but very rarely led to this sexual predator thing that we see in males. It's the males' kind of evolutionary drive to perform and prove themselves that leads to them abusing weaker individuals, while the females, being the more receptive sex, I guess it's just a promiscuosity that manifests itself. But still, both sides, beyond a certain age, both sexes, if that behavior continues, it's clearly not a sign of good health, even if it doesn't involve abusing minors. Serial sexual partners while married, several studies have been published on that. Some of them have been retracted because the feminist movement said, no, it denigrates women, tries to tell us that one woman should always be with one man. Nobody's saying should. All we're saying is that invariably the males or the females who stray from a stable relationship in middle age tend to have an underlying health issue. That's all we're saying. Both sexes, again, I emphasize.
Wow. Well, that is a lot of information to take in. So, I really appreciate you hopping on here. Where can people find you as far as Twitter, website, all that good stuff?
So I have a blog. I go under the moniker Haidut, spelled H-A-I, D as in dog, U, T as in Tom. So my blog is haidut.me, M-E. And then everything I post on the blog automatically gets linked to Twitter, like a quick excerpt, just a title and a few tags of the blog post. And it's the same thing. It's twitter.com/haidut. And also post on the infamous Rapeed forum. This is where I started posting back in 2011. My alias there is also Haidut. And usually whatever I post on the blog, I also post on the forum. But if people want to engage in a discussion with me, it's the forum that's the best venue, because I've turned off the comments on the blog because I simply cannot. I mean, first of all, it's a lot of spam, right? Second of all, I can't answer everybody individually on the forum. If people ask a question, even if I can't personally attend to it, there is a community of 10,000 plus people, and they're all pretty well versed in many of the things that we've discussed today. And they're usually pretty eager to chime in and offer their take on whatever question. Quite a few threads on sexual health, sexual performance, both for males and females at any age. I'm saying over 18, but like by any age, mean even older people. We recently had a discussion there on the forum of a lady in her, I think it was 80s. She was asking basically how she can restore her sexual desire. Apparently trying just a little bit, like 20 milligrams 20 milligrams of progesterone, quickly restored her sexual desire. Her husband, who was also in his 80s, for some reason had maintained his sexual health and desire throughout throughout his entire life, and you know, she was feeling like she was just disappointing him. So you, often it's very simple things like that. And they went on vacation, which I also, I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it was just the progesterone. She took the progesterone, but also went on vacation, which they hadn't done in 20 years, and it resulted apparently in them having sex daily, which she thought was impossible at her age, or was inappropriate, or whatnot. She came back, you know, a changed person, and shared her experience with the forum. And so anyways, all of these topics, there's nothing taboo there. You know, they're being discussed, including people, you know, there's no problem discussing topics of even homosexual sex. I mean, there's several alternative interests there that are being discussed as well. So whatever your question is posted there, and the community is usually pretty polite and pretty non-judgmental and will tell you what they think. You don't have to like it, but they tend to be very non-judgmental, which I think is a great start in a discussion.
Definitely. Awesome. And then also you have all of your products on Idea Labs, correct?
Yes, that's right. I have a small boutique company. The website is Idea Labs. You know, it's like a labs for ideas, right? But it's Idea and then L-A-B-S. And then D.C. because we're in District of Columbia. So all one word, idealabsdc.com. So if people just go there, they'll see that I have a number of different products, including progesterone and DHEA products that we mentioned. Again, I would encourage changing your lifestyle first, if possible, before you jump on the supplementation. But if there's proven issue with hormone imbalances or neurotransmitter imbalances, sometimes supplementation may be needed. I try not to be a pill pusher or a product pusher. Again, if you can resolve these things naturally without by simply changing around your lifestyle and making things more spontaneous and less stressful, for the vast majority of people, it tends to work out. But if you're in a situation where not much can be done to change it, then there are other ways that we can help.
Definitely. Well, Georgie, I really do appreciate you hopping on here. Thank you for your time, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to hit the like button, subscribe, and leave a comment.